So welcome to our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning. But today it's a special Lunch and Learn sponsored by the wonderful Kollel Aharon Valeya. So we thank our anonymous benefactors, the Kollel Aharon Valeya, for delicious food, and to the Levies with the Around the Table Catering for supplying such wonderful food. And again, today's Lunch and Learn I'm dedicating to my late father, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Reb Shimon Ben Yerachmiel, should be an aliyah for his neshama, an elevation for his soul with our learning today. So today's class is Red Cows and Talking Donkeys. So we are behind Israel by 1 week, because Passover was a Shabbat Shavuot, it interfered, and we've always been playing catch up. So Israel's like one parsha ahead of us. This week we catch up. So this week we have, oh joy, not one but two Torah readings, right? We have Chukas, Chukat, and Balak. So we're going to try to have a little short, directed class today that's going to talk about the red cow, which is the Chukat Parshan, and the talking donkey, which is the Balak, the Shrek's donkey portion. So let's look at source one. This is the opening gambit of our Parsha Chukat. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the statute of the Torah, which the Lord commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel and have them take for yourselves, a perfectly red, unblemished cow upon which no yoke was laid." Never worked. So the red cow, the Parah Aduma, is one of the most mysterious of all the laws in the Torah. So in the Torah, we have divisions amongst the many commandments, right? There's 613 commandments, and some of them are called Mishpatim, which are rules that have a little bit of sense in them. You can almost say, well, you know, it makes sense that I should honor my father and mother. They gave me life and I have to pay back. So many of the rules, the laws, they don't necessarily even have to say this is the reason, but a human being will find them reasonable. But then there's another group called Chukim, these laws that are just decrees from God. And a decree from God means do it because the king said you have to follow his ordinances. You can read into it whatever you want. Good luck with the red heifer. But at the end of the day, you do it because you have a relationship with God. You want to love God and he loves you. And you want to have that reciprocal arrangement with him. And therefore, we do it not because we have the sense and sensibility factor, but because we want that relationship with God. We just do it. You know, like the worst words a little child ever says to mom or dad, why? I was guilty all the time. Why, Ima? Why, Abba? Like, why do I have to do that? And mom and dad don't generally take very well to the why, because they look at you and say, why? Because I asked you to, please. And if you go beyond there, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. So let's look at source two, which is a Rashi, and he talks about the nature of this one individual rule, the red heifer, the Parah Aduma. And he says, because, I love it, Satan, the Satan, and the nations of the world taunt Israel, the Jewish people, and they say, what is this commandment? Meaning this is idiocy. And what purpose does it have? Therefore, the Torah uses the term statute. God says, I have decreed it. You have no right to challenge it. So this seems to be the sticking point and the point that is a focal point of the, not so much animosity, but the derision cast by others towards the Jewish people. In other words, they look at it and they throw their hands up and they say, it doesn't make any sense. There's no rhyme or reason here. Now, before we unpackage this Rashi, which I think is pretty formidable, just have a look at source 3, and you'll see why the nations of the world make fun of this one issue. It just doesn't seem to make any sense on any level. And the one who sprinkles the sprinkling waters which contained the ashes of the red heifer, our rabbi said that the one who sprinkles is actually ritually clean. But this teaches us that the one who carries the purifying waters becomes defiled with astringent uncleanliness. For even the clothes of that person who carried the ashes with the water that he is wearing, they're contaminated, unlike the one who merely touches the sprinkling waters. So look, I want you to hear this. A person comes in contact with someone dead. So they are tameh, they're ritually impure. Now, all of these rules don't apply today, except if you're a kohen, if you're a priest, even though you're considered under the status of ritual impurity, because that's just, we're all ritually impure, you may or may not know that a kohen, for example, unless it's, God forbid, a mom, dad, someone very close to them, they're not allowed to set foot in a cemetery in areas where people are buried because of the status. A kohen has a special status, a priest. Okay. That said, in times of old, when there was a temple and people actually had ritual purity possible through this process of Poland Springs water mixed with, little shout out to our sponsor, the Poland Springs water mixed with the ashes of the red heifer, and it would magically, we don't know how exactly, transform a person who had been in contact with the dead, and they would be tahor, they'd be ritually pure. So it's a mystery, and it's spiritually, shall we say, inaccessible to us. It's inaccessible. We can't access the reason why. But you see how crazy it is, right? Think about it. One red heifer would be killed. Sorry for the red heifer, the cow. But he would last for like generations. The ashes were used in very minute quantities, and they'd be mixed with the mayim chayim, with this water that was alive, meaning spring-type water. That's why you mentioned Poland Springs. Little ad there. And what happened was, the person, the Kohen, let's say, who carried the ashes and the water mixture, they themselves, by touching the red heifer's dead body, because that's what the ashes are, cremated red heifer, it would make the person carrying the ashes that he would have to then get the water sprinkled on him because he'd become ritually impure. But wait a minute. The whole purpose of the concoction that you're carrying is to give us spiritual cleanliness. So why would it be that by touching the ashes, which are like super duper concentrated purifying mechanism, why would that make me ritually impure? It doesn't make any sense, right? I'm going to make a little joke here. I'm sorry. So remember, the red heifer is sort of related to the cow, the ox. So this is truly an oxymoron. Come on, that was pretty good. That was actually pretty. Rabbi Larry Kaplan would be proud of me, okay? That was for him. That was for him, right? That was for him. That was good. He'd be like, you know, Rabbi Kaplan, you're pretty good. It was good. It was good. Lots of groans, but it's funny. So it literally is a conundrum. How can it be? So the nations of the world will look at us and say, you Jewish people, like, this is ridiculous. Why do you need a red cow and the ashes and the water, and then the people involved somehow become impure? I don't see, like, you don't look unclean. If you go to the, you know, to take a bath and a shower and you look beautiful, sparkling, clean, I can't see the soul factor. I don't know that your neshama is pure or impure. So what difference does it make? So it's a source of derision. So look at source two again. The Satan. And the nations of the world taunt Israel. So first of all, Satan is not the Christological Satan that you may think he is. Satan is another word for like the adversarial angel. He is the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And the whole purpose of this character, he's an angel. It's a tough gig, by the way, because I don't think there's a lot of, you don't have like a lot of Facebook followers who are giving you a thumbs up. Well, job, Yitzhara, you got me again, you know. I was on the wagon from eating this and this, or got me back in the nicotine patch, you know. He's the guy that tempts you. Now, before you hate on him, as they say today, remember, it's a tough gig, but it's a necessary gig. Because if you didn't have somebody tempting you, what great reward would you have? If you're robotic and have like a code built in by God, I will never do something sinful. But think about it. It's an amazing idea, right? In other words, the Yetzer Hara balances the equation. Because you have a Yetzer HaTov, please God, right? A good inclination that drives you. You know that little, we always have visions as a child of the two little angels on the shoulder. You know, the little devil guy and the little angel guy. And every time you have $10 and you're thinking, okay, this could go to the poor person in front of the Dunkin' Donuts, or the $10 could be used, wow, how much candy I could buy at the grocery store, and the little kid's tempted, which angel is he going to look and follow their path, right? But it's a serious thing, because think about it. in the absence of the alternative, Satan, the angel who tries to tempt you, then naturally you're going to take that $10 and give it to tzedakah, to charity. So do you deserve a pat on the back for that? No, because you're essentially an angel. An angel doesn't have free choice. Only human beings have free choice. So the ability to choose between right and wrong, good and evil, is something that is not only important for us, it's essential in our avodah and how we serve God, right? Because in the absence of that, we're essentially computers. You're like an Apple iPhone that they usually work pretty well, right? No malware and stuff. So essentially, we need that Yetzirah. So the Yetzirah sort of says, he whispers sweet nothings into the ears of the Jewish people. He says, you Jews, you have a Torah, and you have this red heifer, this oxymoronic, ridiculous commandment. Obviously, it's a window into all the commandments. They have no rhyme or reason. So just give it up. You're never going to know why you're doing it. And our answer is, guess what, pal? I don't need to know, but I do need to have a relationship with God, my creator. And therefore, I hear you. It doesn't make sense to me, but who cares? At the end of the day, it'll make sense when I go to the next world. Or not. I don't care. I want a relationship. Just like I have a relationship with my own father and mother who brought me into this world. God was the third silent partner with my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. I want to have that relationship with God, so I'm not going to hear anything you have to say. So the red heifer, then, is literally an entree into the nature of why we have that relationship, the challenges inherent in the relationship that we have ongoing. So it's a very powerful, powerful idea of the red heifer. Okay, enough of the red heifer. And by the way, if you're thinking, I'm going to investigate after Kaplan's class, and I will come to the solution of the oxymoron, good luck, because King Solomon, who's a little bit wiser than probably the cumulative wisdom of our entire world, he really looked exhaustively into this one commandment. And you know what Solomon says? I really tried, guys. He said, I looked, and I studied everything. I turned over every leaf, and I was not able to decipher the mystery of the red heifer. So again, good luck if you think you have the wisdom of Solomon and beyond. Okay, so just take it as a Jewish little sigil that we wear proudly. Everything we do doesn't have to come with a reason. We do it because that's what God expects of us. At the end of the day, I do commandments because, not because it's reasonable to me, and it may be. And that, and by the way, it's delicious. When you can taste in a commandment why you're doing it, all the better, because that's a motivator to constantly encourage us to defeat Satan and the dark side, yeah? But the bottom line is we do it because we do it. And that's the nature of the entirety of Torah. So it's a powerful way of looking at the Torah. Let's get into some other issues here. Let's look at source number 4. So in our Parsha Chukat, we lose the leadership of the entire generation. Now, who were the three great leaders? The siblings. You have Miriam, the firstborn. You have Aaron. And you have Moses. Those three were the leadership of the entire generation from Egypt through the Exodus to the revelation at Mount Sinai to the precipice, so to speak, of entering the promised land of Israel. Okay. In our parsha, we lose all three. Two literally, and one is sentenced to death. So we lose Miriam early on in the parsha. Miriam, the young little girl at age 5, was able to convince mom and dad to get back together and have another child that became Moses, the one who waits there by the reeds of the Nile as the crocodiles are swarming around little Moses in the basket. And the daughter, Princess Bithya, comes down and saves little Moses. That little Miriam dies in our Parsha. And then when she dies, the Jewish people lose the magical, sorry to do the commercial again, the Poland Springs, the water, the Be'er, the magical water which would follow them through their sojourn, the 39 plus almost 40 years in the desert wandering around, for the generation that sinned with the spies to kind of pass away, and the younger generation then merit to going in the land. That spring of water left the Jewish people because she left the Jewish people. Wow. And that, of course, leads us to Moses getting frustrated, and in his anger and frustration at the rabble, he strikes the rock. And he doesn't get to enter Israel. So he is sentenced to death.
And then Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, the great high priest, he dies. So we lose the entire generation in one parsha. But that makes sense, right? Because what does the paraduma, the red heifer, come thematically to address? Death. Contact with death. The mystery, the greatest mystery of life is death. 100%, right? So you see, thematically, the entire parsha is built on chukat, the statute, which comes, the red heifer, to both address death itself, if contact with the physical nature of death, and the spirituality and the mystery of life and death itself. And then, not surprisingly, we lose the three great leaders to death. So it's very, shall we say, thematically consistent. Okay? So let's look at the Jewish people's reaction when they lose Aaron. The entire house of Israel cried. They mourned when Aaron dies. Both the men and the women. Why? For Aaron had pursued peace. He promoted love between disputing parties and between man and wife. So we are given this incredible insight into Aaron by the Mishnah, the oral tradition in Pirkei Avot, in the ethics of our fathers. It says, Hevei mitalmidav shel Aharon. You should strive to be a student of Aaron. You should love peace, pursue peace, love all your fellow human beings. And that was Aaron. Aaron was the ultimate mediator. He would mediate between couples, siblings, between all Jews. He had a unique ability, Aaron, like no one else in human history that we know of, to see the greatness and potentiality in each of us. And instead of feeling, oh my gosh, that person's brighter than me, a little bit more beautiful, a little bit, you know, better voice, whatever the issues were, he didn't feel that it was somehow a detraction from his own grandeur. No, he saw each of us as the unique individuals that we are. And I'm looking around the table, a lot of amazing, talented individuals. And Aaron was able to ascribe import to each of us in our own journey in life. And he was able not to feel kinah, jealousy, at your or my success, but rather he felt empowered and elevated. And therefore he was able to mirror back to the people who they were and who they could be. And so people just fell in love with Aaron because he loved you and everyone loved him. So he was even more popular, believe it or not, than Moses or Miriam. Because, you know, Moses had some heavy lifting. As Moses, the rabbi, sometimes the rabbi's decisions can be binding and tough, especially on the party that perceives that they lost during the adjudication of a case or something. There can be some, you know, little breikus, as they say in Yiddish, bad feelings towards the rabbi. So Moses, somehow, because he's the king, not everyone is going to buy into everything he says. But Aaron, no. Aaron went out of his way to make shalom. That's why he's the ultimate pursuer of peace. But he didn't do it at all costs, because it says he was a rodeh of shalom. Sometimes he has to run after peace, which even means taking the difficult approach if necessary. But that was Aaron. So in the absence of Aaron, what happened? Machloket. Division and arguments arose within the Jewish people. There was no Aaron to mediate anymore. And so people were at loggerheads, and there were divisions that started to come up between Jew versus Jew. Husbands and wives, friends, they had animus. There was no Aaron to go to anymore. So what happened? Whenever in Jewish history we fight from within, somebody on the outside notices this. And there's a little nation, and they're mentioned in the Bible, in the Torah, way back in Exodus, in a place called Rephidim, and they're called Amalek. And you know who they are. Bad guys. And every generation, they're kind of around, but they morph into something a little different in every generation. So the original iteration occurs when the Jewish people are in conflict and the divisions with us and with God. We say, is God in our midst or not? And all of a sudden, Amalek rears his ugly head for the first time there in Rephidim, and he chases after us, and there's a cloud protecting us, so he can only get the older people, the people who are cast out from the protective clouds that surrounded the Jewish people. And there's a war there. Moses goes up and prays, and Joshua leads the troops, and they defeat Amalek at that moment, okay? Because there is a division between God and the Jewish people. A little later on, you have a division between God and the Jewish people right here. But now it's not just God who is on the outside, it's Jew versus Jew, as you see. In the absence of Aaron, the Jews are left unprotected, both from within, meaning they're fighting, so there's no protection from Aaron to mediate. And guess what was the protector of all the Jewish people? The clouds of glory. The clouds of glory, the Anenei HaKavod, left because Aaron died. So we didn't have the physical force field that we did have at Rephidim when they attacked. So now Amalek says, hey, wait a minute. We hear murmurings. It's all over the social media. The Jewish people are fighting. Husbands, wives, brothers, sisters. There's tumult and decay within the Jewish camp. So how do we know that Amalek shows up? Look at source number 5. The Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the south, heard that Israel had come by the route of the spies, and he, the Canaanite king of Arad, waged war against Israel and took from them a captive, a single captive. Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will deliver this people into my hand, I shall consecrate their cities. The Lord heard Israel's voice, delivered the Canaanite. He destroyed them and consecrated their cities, and he called the place Horma. Okay, number 6, the Canaanite heard. He heard what? What I just said, that Aaron had died, and therefore the clouds of glory had departed, and in the absence of Aaron, there was now division within the Jewish people. But the rabbi said, wait a minute, the Canaanites didn't live in the south. 7, this refers to Amalek, says the great commentator Rashi. As it says, giving us the geography of the land of Israel, the Amalekites dwell in the south land. So what did the Amalekites do? They had a trick. They were sneaky guys. They changed their language to speak in the language of Canaan so that the Israelites would pray to the Holy One, blessed is he, to God, to deliver the Canaanites into their hand. And since they were not Canaanites, the prayers of the Jews would have no effect. But Israel saw that they were dressed like Amalekites, though they spoke in a Canaanite tongue. So instead of asking God, please save us from the Canaanites, they made a generic prayer. We will pray generally for success if you deliver his people into my hand. So that means the following. Amalek smells victory against the Jews. Why? Because there's no Aaron. So physically, the force field, remember in Star Wars, you have the Death Star had its force field. So invert it that it's the kosher Star Wars, okay? And that Death Star shield had come down because Aaron dies. But more than that, because of the machlokas, because of the no Aaron to mediate disputes and division within the Jews, they think, hey, let's go get him. So they don't even dress like Amalekites, and they try to use subterfuge, and they come, but they lose. Okay. So before we go on, I want you to think about this. We always look for themes, right? Consistency within the Torah. So this is going to bend your mind just a little bit. It's tough, but has to be said. So they first appear on the scene of Amalek, because as we said, there's that division. Is God in our midst or not? The division between God and his people. Right here, they show up again because Aaron's gone. And in the absence of Aaron, there's no more peace within the Jewish camp. Okay? Later on, the most famous Amalekite of all is Haman. Do you remember what Haman says to the king? Why he's ready to kill the Jews? He says, there's a certain nation. He doesn't mention the Jews. There's a certain people who are Mifurad, Mifuzar, Mifurad, Beina Amin. They are scattered and divided among the Jews. The word division is there. So what is Haman saying to the king? If the Jews were unified, we can't touch them. We dare not mess with the Jews because they're going to have divine protection. They're together as one unit. But if they're divided, we can conquer them. So that's right there in the story of Esther. So when Mordechai and Esther try to undo the evil, nefarious plan of Haman, what's the first step? Kinos, gather all the Jews together in prayer. All the Jews should put aside the petty differences that destroy us, come together as a unified unit, and God will hopefully help Esther and will save the day and win, which we did. So you see this common theme every single time. There are divisions within the Jews. Amalek senses this, and he's there to attack, to challenge us. What was going on in Israel on October 6th of 2023? Do you remember judicial reform? You probably don't understand, because I don't understand. I don't live there. The country where literally there was bloodletting on the streets on Yom Kippur. People got into fights up on a mechitza in Tel Aviv or how you pray. It was Jew versus Jew. You think Hamas, which is perhaps one of the modern day iterations of Amalek, because remember, every generation, they become something a little different. Do you think they don't see the reality that it's Jew versus Jew in Israel, and that half of Israel is on one side and half is on the other side? You think that's coincidental? It can't be, right? And what about now? Look at the divisions we have in our world. Right now, Israel's fighting. Who will be drafted? How will the really religious, you know, should they serve? And how will they serve? There are divisions right now. So there's tumult within. It is not a coincidence that when we fight ourselves, Amalek can fight us. And in the absence, if we can be like Aaron and be peacemakers and mediators, then Amalek is not even going to have the chutzpah, the audacity, to challenge us. So it's a very sobering idea. And again, we know the easy answer is just to drop all the little issues that divide us and to look at what connects us. So it's a powerful idea from our parsha. It's right here in our parsha, right here, that Amalek continually senses and is probing us for weakness. And that weakness always seems to be self-imposed, Jew versus Jew. And so therefore, how do we get that love? We need to sort of channel Aaron. And I've mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning again. Aaron had a unique ability to see and love every Jew. How did he do that? Because instead of seeing you as a challenge to him, he saw you as a unique individual that will never be, in the history of our world, created again. And each of us has a unique mission in this world. And if you could become something wonderful in whatever endeavor you choose, instead of seeing it as diminishing Aaron, au contraire, Aaron saw it as an elevation of God in our world. And so he loved it. And again, I'm going to use the metaphor of the World Cup of soccer right now, okay? It is so delightful to see our world, just temporarily, you've noticed this, right? The patriotism, the unity that each nation feels, they all spend like thousands of dollars for these seats, you know, and they like, it's amazing. If you go on StubHub and try to get a ticket, you know, for one of these games, good luck. They're like 3-4 digits. It's like you're sitting with Spike Lee at one of those Knicks games getting a ticket to like France, Norway. Good luck, right? But they all wear, if you notice, they all wear their colors. They all have really cool songs. The Norwegians are there doing their rowing thing. I mean, it's so much, it's like a schmuck. Aaron, if he was here right now with us, he would be cheering and say, oh my gosh, it's delightful. It doesn't matter who wins. But the fact that human beings are capable of such physical prowess and excellence, and the fact that you can just enjoy, in other words, okay, I understand that maybe when Iran is playing right now, we're not cheering for them. Okay, I understand, I get it, okay. There's a caveat here. But by and large, a lot of these countries, you and I would be like challenged to find them on a map. Let's be honest, right? Right? I'd say, exactly where are the Cape Verde Islands? You'd be like, Rabbi, I was there, by the way. I had a stopover when I was once traveling to South Africa, to London, to New York. I had like a refueling stop, literally in the Cape Verde Islands. And I'm not exaggerating to say it was like something out of like Humphrey Bogart. You know, I had one of those fans going around about 1 mile an hour. Humidity was somewhere between Miami and hell. And we got off the plane to get a drink. I remember spending about $12 on a generic Coke, but bless them for having something, right? And it was like a one camel, one sheep place. I was there. So the fact that they have a World Cup team, I mean, they're getting shechted, they're getting wiped out, but bravo that the Cape Verde Islands are there, you know? So if we could just be like Aaron and extol the virtues of one another and not feel somehow that your success diminishes my success, that is the approach of Aaron. That's the mahalach. That is the way we should approach our world. And if we could all see ourselves with that incredibly, I mean, at the 250th birthday of our magical country coming up, and I know that politics has messed a lot of it up, but if we could just step back, and we have an amazing American soccer team, by the way, yeah. And you can wear the colors proudly when you're watching the World Cup, because they're great. They're fantastic. So let's enjoy, let's revel in the errant accomplishment of what is possible in our world. So I promised Talking Donkey, so I'm going to be, do I have 6-7 more minutes of your time? Okay. So let's talk. Eddie Murphy would be very, very upset with me if I leave out Shrek's Talking Donkey. So let's cut to the chase. Bilam, the wicked prophet of the world, is hired by the king of Moab, the Moabites, King Balak, to go and use his magical Moses-like powers to curse the Jewish people. And he promises him a kingdom of gold if he is successful. And so on his journey, God basically says to Bilam, well, where are you going, pal? And he says, well, the king has hired me. I have my Cayman Islands, Cape Verde bank accounts that need replenishment. You know, your Lord, is it okay if I go? And God is not happy with Bilam. He kind of ignores God and he plays a little loose with God's edict. And he goes with the men, with the emissaries of King Balak. And they're on their journey. And he's riding his donkey. Okay. Not once. Not twice, but three times the donkey does something weird, strange, the donkey's never done. First the donkey goes one way and then the other way, and then finally just literally like lays down in the middle of the road. And Bilam is decidedly unhappy, and he takes out his stick, you know, he's ready to beat the donkey, and then the donkey does something kind of remarkable. He communicates with Bilam. We don't exactly know how that happened, but the donkey's talking. Now, the most delightful thing is the idea that if you look at Bilam's reaction to the talking donkey, he's like totally not shaken at all. Like, I don't know how you would feel if you were visiting the Bronx Zoo and you went by, let's say, the gorillas. They're always, my little son, when Tully was little, loved the gorillas, right? Henry, the big gorilla, you know, you look at him, right? So what if Henry looked to you and said, hey, Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi, how are you today? I promise you, after you revive me, after the paramedics came, it would be impactful. I wouldn't just like, oh, this is just another day at the zoo, right? But Bilam is like, he's like totally like nonchalant, right? And they have this dialogue back and forth. And he basically says to the donkey, if I had a sword with me instead of my stick, I would kill you on the spot. And the donkey basically says to him, really? Big shot? You're going with the power of words to destroy God's chosen people, yeah? And I'm your lowly donkey, and you need a sword to kill me? Really? Like, think about that for a moment. But there's even a greater musser, little shtoch, as they say in Yiddish. He's giving him, the donkey, or she is giving Bilam a lot of food for thought. Here's the takeaway. I'm speaking now, Bilam, yeah? And you speak, or you claim to have the power of speech to curse the Jews through the power of speech, just like Moses was given the unique power of speech. And we know it goes all the way back to Kol Yaakov. Jacob was originally given this power. We have power to pray and invoke change in our lives. So you're going to curse the Jewish people, yeah? Do I normally speak? Never, not once. I've been your loyal donkey all these years. Never once have I said a word, right? There's not, like, so let me ask you a question, Mr. Bilam. The fact that I'm speaking to you now and I see that right in front of us is an angel of death. Remember that Satan guy? He's right there with a sword ready to murder you. Only you, hotshot Navi, prophet of the nations, you didn't see the angel. So the three times that I went left, right, and then crushed and went down, I was doing it to save your life, Bilam, because the angel would have murdered you. But you didn't see the angel. Only I saw the angel. So in one moment, God snapped his fingers. He defrocked you because you are blind to the angel, the great prophet and seer. And the lowly donkey, me, moi, I see the angel. So what could that mean to you, Bilam? What's the takeaway? So instead of responding, I sinned. I mean, he kind of does a little bit. Not really. But instead of going home and saying, hey, you know, I get it, Mr. Donkey, God's given me a very sobering message that the power of speech is not unique to me, it belongs to the Jewish people. How dare I have the audacity to try to hurt them with the power of speech, which is their special, unique koach, their strength. And more than that, if God makes someone a Navi, God makes them a Navi. They don't have inherent prophetic powers. It's something that's gifted from God. And I should be a little more humble in my approach. No, Bilaam doesn't get it. So let me ask you a question. If Bilaam is such a donkey, what is his greatness? And before you say, God, you know, Rabbi, come on, how great is he? Well, look at the last source. The Torah ends with the words in number 8. This is like literally like one of the end verses of our entire Bible. End of Deuteronomy, right? Listen to this. And there was no other prophet who arose in Israel like Moses. And I'll just quote the Rashi. You can take it home and quote yourself. Among Israel, the Jewish people, after Moses died, there was no one as great as Moses. But what about the nations of the world? There was one unique man as great as Moses, Bilaam. Bilaam had the potentiality to be the Moses of the nations of the world, so that the nations of the world couldn't have a defense. What was their defense if they did criminal activity before God? They could say the following. We didn't have a Charlton Heston leading us into the wilderness and giving us the Torah as our teacher. We didn't have Moses. Had you gifted us a Moses, we would have been much better. So please don't punish us. And God's response would be, I gave you Bilaam. How did that work out, guys? And Bilaam, in other words, was the Moses equivalent, potentially. Of course, he sought darkness and killed himself. That's a separate issue. What was the strength then of Bilaam? If he didn't have the ability to see the angel, but the donkey has that ability, he doesn't sound very formidable. He sounds a little Shrekish and a little lampoonish, yeah? So what is this great magical power that we ascribe to Bilaam? So Bilaam, we are told, had one unique quality. He knew how to swear. He could curse. Boy, could he curse. But curses don't really have any real impact unless you are privy to a little moment every 24 hours where God potentially could judge any human being on earth. When God creates the Genesis Project, he created it with absolute judgment. So if a person commits a crime, you don't wait for Yom Kippur, for the Day of Atonement, to hopefully resolve the issue with God by repenting. No, God is absolute and says, din, judgment. You do this, you're going to have to be held accountable in the moment. So when God changed that design and made it a world of rachamim, of mercy, he had to sort of have one moment every 24 hours where there was that pure judgment. But that moment was not static. It was variable. So every 24 hours, there was like a moment in time where God could hold any human being or nation accountable for their crime if in that moment they would be exposed to him for judgment. So that was Bilaam. Bilaam could somehow calculate that moment in time, which was variable, every 24 hours, that moment where he could use and manipulate God's judgment against anybody in the world. Now, the rabbis in the Talmud say, well, how long was that moment? It was like less than a nanosecond. Basically, you couldn't even get a good four-letter curse in. Right? So the rabbis have a whole debate. They say maybe he could like say very fast, Tlaim! Destroy them. And how would he do this? He basically, in that moment, maybe would take like a Polaroid, a snapshot of, let's say, the Jews around the golden calf, and he would hold it up. Whoosh, destroy them! And at that moment, God hadn't destroyed them because he was pushing the punishment away down the generations. So in that moment, potentially, if God would see that picture of the golden calf, the crime of the century for the Jews, maybe God would harshly punish the Jews in that moment. And God said to Bilaam, guess what, pal? You will not have access to that moment. For all the days that Bilaam was probing God's judgment to seek out that moment, God withheld that moment. And he actually talks about it elsewhere in the Torah, that I did a mercy for you by withholding from Bilaam the potential to destroy. Okay, so what really, what's going on? What does that mean? A moment. So this is where it gets to our world today. The word is context. You see, if I hold up a picture to you, a Polaroid, is that reflective of reality? Well, I mean, it's reflective of a moment of reality, of a nanosecond, yeah? But think about, do you remember what paparazzi are? I don't know if they still, I'm guessing in England they probably do because they have all those tabloids there. But these guys are the guys with the big photo lenses that are like 8 feet long, and they wait on treetops and from hotel rooms, and they're always around like Buckingham Palace waiting for like, you know, Meghan and Harry to show up, or Andrew, the bad guy, or Charles, you know, or maybe one of the little Charles and Kate's, you know, little children is having ice cream on her nose or something, and they'll get like a snapshot and sell it to one of these tabloids, front page, right? They're horrible people. Now, let me ask you, if somebody is yawning or looking like a buffoon in one picture, is that reflective of a reality? Of course not. It's reflective of a snapshot you got. So the Queen of England, by the way, Elizabeth had a rule. She never, I think the royals still have this rule. They don't eat publicly. So when they're at a ceremonial lunch or a dinner, because my father, Oliver Shalom, was invited along with a couple hundred other journalists in Canada to Ottawa, and he actually had like a dinner, kosher dinner with the Queen. And I asked him, what was it like? And he said, well, she was pretty regal. I said, Dad, I said, Abba, did like she eats, that she doesn't eat in public. And he explained to me that the fear would be that, you know, you take a mouthful of your dinner and I get that snapshot of the Queen open mouth with the food. It's going to be on the front of the National Intruder the next day, right? So, but yet it's not indicative of a reality, because you, what are you doing with that picture? You're sucking away the context of the reality, and you're presenting one picture as reality. That means there was 1 second before and 1 second after are stripped away, and sans context, a picture could mean anything. Now, does this sound familiar to you? What are the Amalekites of our world? What are they doing to the Jewish people? You can't even debate them on October 6th and before, because either they're too stupid or just don't care about anything that happened before October. Even October 7th now has been scrubbed. And the reality of us as apartheid, genocide, colonialists, the birth of that narrative, which is a beautiful, Bilam, if he was alive today, oh my gosh, he'd be cheering. He'd be going, yay, wow, bravo. You are stripping away all history, all context to the Jews and to the situation in Israel. Bravo, you guys are learning from me. You're my students. In fact, in Pirkei Avot it says, you can have students of Abraham or students of Bilam. I dare say Bilam has a whole lot more students who are really following Bilam University. They're right there with him. And he, from wherever he is down under, he's cheering and he's feeling really happy right now. Because think about it. If you strip away even October 7th and ignore everything that happened before, then anything that happens post October 7th, wow, my gosh, you never look good when you're fighting a war. How could you? By the way, do they ever mention the underground North Korean assisted tunnel system that they built, which made Israel's choices very limited? And by the way, I don't know if you noticed, but the war of Amalek that happened here, that was quoted here, Israel fought the war. Did you catch that? One captive was taken. And Israel fought a war against Amalek to retrieve that captive from captivity. Wow, does that sound familiar? So in other words, today's world, and again, it's not just limited to Israel, it's with everything. We strip away all of history, either we don't care about it, or we have an agenda to ignore it, which is even more pernicious and horrible. But how do you and we and myself, how do we supply context? Because we have to learn for ourselves, history, right? And we try to engage people with history, with books, with education, for ourselves. Because I don't know about you, but like it's like when you say the word Zionist, the word Zion, Z-I-O-N, is like a four-letter word now. Not exaggerating. I had somebody at the arena when I was leaving the hockey game, lost the sixth game in overtime. Sorry, Moshe. I'm walking out, and this guy looks at my yarmulke and says, yeah, I want... He was probably 25 beers into the night. I want to get one of those. And I'm thinking, oh, here it comes, right? And then he said, yeah, I want to be able to tell the world to, you know, with the F word off. So I'm thinking, well, I guess he was trying to be nice. He basically was saying that the fact that you had a chutzpah to wear a yarmulke in public, knowing that people might, you know, spit on you or worse, Bravo. So that was his way, I guess, of extolling my courage, I think. But that's the world. You know, I'm in Wegmans sometimes and people will come over to me and I, oh, right. It's generally not good. But honestly, post-October 7, I have people come over to me and just say, hey, Rabbi, or whoever you are, I just want to let you know I'm on your side. I'm with you. I have your back. Bravo. Right? So Baruch Hashem, it's a great feeling. We don't get enough of that love and tender warmth these days. But I think for ourselves, maybe the greatest way we can fight the Bilams of the world, the lack of context, the one little picture photo that speaks volumes that is sheker, that's pure garbage, right? It's both phony baloney and there's no Oscar Mayer involved, right? So the only way we can win that battle is to continually fight by supplying history and context to Israel. So again, I know a lot of the Torah here we brought into our day, right? We brought into the idea of Aaron and what we can do to heal the wounds, the rifts that occur in our community and in Israel. And with that, may God bless the Jewish people, because the ultimate protection is going to come from the protective clouds, whatever they mean, metaphorically or literally, that God is going to supply. May we merit, by working on our own little interpersonal skills, God's divine protection from Bilam and the Amalekites. Thank you, everyone.